This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, the business station. My name is Rich Bradbury. Today, I'm in the studio, as ever, with Daniel Fernandez from DSF.my. Say hello.
Hola, ¿cómo está, my friend?
It's Spanish today. Over here, we have, of course, a man with the news. It is Arif Ruz. Say hello.
Hello.
Now, this is Cruise Control, the car show here on BFM 89.9. A little bit of a different show for you today. It's a bit of a decade in review of the auto industry.
Yeah.
So we're looking back at some of the movers and shakers, the biggest and the breakers of some of the big stories that happened, of course, within the last 10 years, in no particular order. And of course, there's always going to be something omitted from shows like this, because you can't fit everything in.
No.
We've kind of cherry-picked some of the things that we think have been very important over the last 10 years.
There's just way too much news to try and get through. So
we've got stuff which I'm sure you guys will go, why haven't you talked about that? You come here and try doing one of these shows.
Exactly. I mean, it's tough, guys. You know, I've been listening to you guys the whole week on different shows and everything else. And being the number one radio station in the nation, probably in ASEAN, I know it's difficult for you to put everything in. Good job. So let's get down to it. So what's the first topic?
Actually, before, you know how last week we were talking about the NEP and why it's delayed and what it's causing, right? So they just recently announced that it's going to be early 2020.
Well, the last time it was Friday the 13th.
Yes.
Now it's early 2020.
Yep. Anyway, on with the show. So one of the many big things that happened in this entire decade was that the rise of crossovers and SUVs. They seem to be everywhere right now, right?
Yep.
Just a few stats for you here.
Go on. He loves his numbers.
I love numbers, yes. That's why I work in data. You know? But the International Energy Agency, they're the people that compile all the global databases and all that stuff. So they say that the global number of SUVs and crossovers multiplied 6 times between 2010 and 2019. So the number actually rose from 35 million SUVs and crossovers to 200 million cars, SUVs and crossovers. The other one is Mercedes-Benz sales in 2016. 40% of their total sales that year were SUVs and crossovers. And there's plenty of reasons why SUVs and crossovers are very, very popular these days. But a few analysts said that the reason why they are growing in popularity is because that SUVs and crossovers actually, you know, allow for higher profit margins and pricing, especially when you consider that they can now be built on the same platforms as regular cars.
Now, it used to be that the SUVs were gas-guzzling, extremely unsafe, prone to rolling over. But these days, they become a lot more useful for families and sedans, of course. There's lots of space for people, easy to get in and out of, luggage space, table riding and handling, minimal difference in fuel economy. That's debatable. And the US experiences so much so that Ford killed all its basic non-crossover cars in the US, and Honda is struggling to sell the Accord.
Can you believe that, Daniel?
Well, it's not a strange phenomenon. If you think about it, actually, all the car brands are having problems selling sedans. Like Mazda for the Mazda 6, the CX-5 is outselling it like crazy. Honda, the CR-V is selling much better. The HR-V is selling much better. You know, Japan recently, car of the year, Toyota RAV4.
Yeah.
You know, overall car of the year. These things are actually good because you know why?
Edumacators, Daniel.
Well, everyone is saying, you know, we need a crossover or SUV or something big and large because we want to feel safer. But has road accidents reduced? That's number one. Number two, people don't realize the cost of owning an SUV and crossover is more than a sedan, because tire costs, brakes, suspension, they're all a little bit more heavy duty. Number three, we are living in developed countries except us, because you know why? There's still flooding going on. But in most developed countries, you don't have flooding, you don't have potholes, you don't have damage that you need to drive an SUV. And then everyone says, oh, it's lifestyle vehicle. This term lifestyle vehicle, I think, has been so loosely used, it's just a joke.
Well, when you buy an SUV, you are rugged. You love an adventure, right?
You can drive it off-road, Daniel.
Yes. You see, the only people who drive SUVs off-road is people like me who go off-road and take photos for your entertainment.
Which is actually just a hill.
But it's still off-road.
It's still off-road.
It's off the road. But the actual SUV owner is not even going off the road.
But like, you know, at the top you saying how that segment has grown.
Yeah.
Massively.
Back in the day, I mean, Mercedes-Benz or BMW wouldn't have even thought to have even six SUVs in their lineup. I mean, X1 to X6, the GLA, GLB, GLC, GLE, GLS, and the G-Wagon, which has like four different variants anyway. So it's huge right now. I mean, even Range Rover, I've noticed something quite interesting is that Range Rover is actually Land Rover, but Land Rover is in itself for the regular people, but the Range Rover
That's a poor man's Range Rover.
Yes, yes. And the Range Rover is for the posh people, right? Yes. But the Range Rover itself has become more than just the Range Rover car. It's, you know, it's Range Rover Evoque, it's the Range Rover Velar, Range Rover Sport, the Range Rover Vogue, the Autobiography. There's so many different types of SUVs.
Wait, they have one called the Autobiography?
Yeah.
Yes, that is the highest spec version.
Yeah. Is it?
That is the creme de la creme of a Range Rover.
The Autobiography.
Yes. You want champagne flutes in your Range Rover? That's how you get it. You
can, in my Autobiography.
Yes.
You can actually get it to be almost a Bentley or Rolls Royce.
That's redonkulous. Yeah.
Yes, yes. I mean, the effect of this whole SUV crossover thing has grown so much that, like I said, we wouldn't have dreamed of a Rolls-Royce SUV called a Cullinan, a Bentley Bentayga.
Of which I saw one recently.
Yeah.
Yes.
Here, outside this building.
They came to pick you up.
No. I wish. It's heading towards your house, I heard.
But no, it came from my house.
Outside the building, and I'm like... I think... was it you that I was... No, it wasn't. Was it you?
Or yeah, yeah, it was.
The two of us were like, is that the... Rolls-Royce SUV. See how my voice has gone?
Yes.
And it's gone up like, you know, four pitches.
Because in your mind, only expats can own it, right? And then you saw a local guy getting out of it.
No, in my mind, I never expected to see one.
Yeah.
You know,
they've actually sold three in Malaysia.
They've sold three, right?
Right. But I tell you something interesting. Mm. Some interesting facts, because you talk about SUVs. Maserati in Malaysia sold 65 luxury vehicles so far this year.
Yeah.
Okay. 45 Maserati Levante SUVs.
Wow.
That's crazy.
And 20 sedans.
Wow.
Aston Martin launched the DBX. 10 units sold. Cars, 7. So you can see the trend.
Yeah.
The trend is moving, whether you like it or not. In every segment, everybody's going up. But, you know, it's strange because these are the same people who at one time will say, I will never get into an SUV because it's an antique car, it's an old man car, you know.
I mean, interesting you brought that up because I was reading into the Mustang Mach-E, which is the SUV electric variant of the Ford Mustang lineup. And the reason why they turned it into an SUV and not just an electric sports car was because they wanted to appeal to the newer audience.
Yeah, they knew.
They knew. Mm-hmm. And everybody was panicking. It was like, oh no, the Mustang is going to die, the Mustang is going to die. But no, it's just a different product for people who are actually going to buy something called a Mustang.
It's still going to sound and look like a Mustang. Yeah. It's just going to be a bit higher.
Yeah.
It's going to look like an SUV.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's an SUV with a Mustang engine.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, the term SUV is so loosely used. The term
back in the day, we would have called it a 4x4.
Exactly. You know, for me, an SUV is basically a Range Rover.
Yes.
That is an SUV. A BMW X5.
Right.
A G-Wagon.
Yes.
That's an SUV.
Yeah.
The rest are all basically hot hatchbacks.
Yes, yes.
That has been jacked out.
Right. Moving on from the crossovers and the SUVs and all that kind of stuff, we're going to have to talk about something that I know Daniel's not a big fan of.
Yeah.
Yes.
Definitely not.
It's a controversial topic on the show, but, you know... we're going to talk a little bit about Tesla.
Yes.
And the impact of the Tesla Model S of all of them.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. So let me make the case.
I'm going to play neither devil's advocate. I'm going to sit right squarely in the middle.
Okay.
Having said that, I will buy a Tesla truck if they're available.
Okay.
Oh, man. But anyway, the Tesla Model S, first shown as a concept in 2008, but it actually came out for production in 2012. And I believe it was the car that spurred the conversation on electric mobility. It was not the first electric car in the 2010 decade. That was the Nissan Leaf. But why this became such a big thing was because it was just the first electric car to be successful as it was, you know, priced in the higher income, upper middle class market, you know, where money and the influence is made all over the world. Mm-hmm. So The Tesla Model S, it proved to people that people will buy into EVs. And it was faster than a BMW M5 of the same time. It was big enough to seat 5, or, you know, they had those rear-facing rear seats in the hatch. So 7 if you had small kids. It had a range of 225 kilometers and can charge to 80% in under an hour with the Tesla supercharger. So all in all, it's quite practical, but people kept asking questions like, it's still an electric car. What if I want to go on long trips? Tesla was like, we'll just place an initial network of chargers all across the main corridors of the highway. So there was one that went from Boston to New York. There was one that went along the PCH, Pan-Californian Highway, I believe is what it's called. So, you know, it sort of like changed.
PCH, you see, he's been there.
I can't afford the visa.
But all of this made the public grow a lot of confidence. They saw the Tesla and they thought, you know what, this can work. I do want to buy a car.
Hang on a minute. Can I say what I think made the public go, this is very interesting, the ridiculous mode or whatever it's called.
Yeah, ludicrous.
Ludicrous mode. Yeah. The fact that you can see what is essentially a dodgem, electric vehicle or whatever, go as fast as it did from a full stop to whatever it was, as fast as it did, and the acceleration that was behind it, everybody went, holy moly, what on earth is this? And the fact that you'd got some guy who essentially could be the world's biggest supervillain, you know, throwing money at this idea and saying, look how fast this thing can go. And it's 225 kilometers. It's not ideal. We know that. But it's cool. It's not as super expensive as you think it's going to be. There's going to be a limited production of this. That idea of a limited production was something that they really pushed out.
Something that Californians absolutely
loved. Everybody loves that now. That's the thing, though. Yeah. And I think it was just this idea of it being super cool, futuristic, and available to a fairly large portion of society. And I think that is what pushed it.
Yeah, and you know, when I was thinking about the impact of this car and why I thought, you know, this changed everything is because I believe during that time in 2012, 2011, 2013, a lot of car companies were going like, yeah, you know, we're going to get there. We're going to get there.
Eventually.
People just aren't ready for EVs. You got to build up the infrastructure and all that stuff. Then Tesla just went, boom. Here's a Tesla Model S. Here's a network of superchargers that we'll put up. I believe there's 13,000 all across US right now. So people realize it worked. And car companies were like, oh, wait, hang on. We do have to rejig ourselves a little bit.
You're not supposed to be there yet, dude. You know, let us catch up.
Exactly. You're a new car company. I mean, the only real competitor to the Tesla Model S right now is the Porsche Taycan, which you drove, Daniel.
Yes.
And it's only been released 7 years after this Tesla Model S came out.
Correct.
And I'm still getting emails about how I wanted to buy one of these things.
Yeah, because your name is
Richard Bradbury, of course. Yeah.
Like I said, there were plenty of other EVs during that time that came out and people much loved, but nobody really wanted to buy.
And you know why? Because they were catering for that, I don't want to say this on it, I'm going to say it, that hippie mentality.
You know?
And if you want to brand it like that, that those friends of the earth, those this, that, and the other, and Tesla said, no, we want to make a car for people who love cars, and we want it to be electrically based.
Yeah, I mean, the first car I ever reviewed was a BMW i3. Mm. Yeah, okay, this is full electric, you got 150 kilometers of range and all that stuff. But much of the press release was just focused on like the cabin and how it was created from like eucalyptus trees, eucalyptus wood.
Yeah, and the recycled whole thing smelled like patchouli oil when you got inside. You know, it was a lava lamp almost inside.
Yeah.
Daniel, come on. I know you're dying to chime in, you know?
Finally, Richard, I'm here. Sorry. Thank you for seeing the humble Malaysian. Anyway, the thing is, okay, number one, I want to come back to Tesla and how they were ahead of everybody else.
Yeah.
You see, with current car manufacturers, 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago, they've been building petrol and diesel engines. Mm. You can't just throw everything away and straight away go into a full electric car. Tesla didn't have that history.
Yeah. Yeah.
He just came and said, one day, I'm going to build an electric car.
Yeah.
He didn't have factories that were already building other forms of engines. And then how do you just throw that all away?
Mm.
You have to stage it slowly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he had that advantage, number one. Number two, to me, he was a guy who sat down and looked at all the radio-controlled cars in his house and said, wow, you know, immediate acceleration, that's what people want because that's what people were talking about. And, you know, when the first Tesla came to Malaysia, I saw it. They didn't let us test drive it. They just showed it to us. After a few months, people started buying it through the GreenTech leasing system. And I knew two people who got it. And both of them, at the same week, called me up and said, you got to test drive this car. So I said, listen, it's too expensive for me to test drive. You show me what it can do, because end of the day, it's like any other car. It's nice, big, it's technology. Fine. The first guy that came, all he did was stop and go, stop and go. Because why? He wanted to show me the acceleration. Wow, neck snapping. Wow, very fast. Wow, you check it out, man. Whoa. And this is the guy who had supercars.
Right, right, right.
But he was so impressed with this. But the second guy was a little bit more, I would say, sensible. Because he said, hey, doing all this, I got to stop soon. I said, why? I'm running out of juice. Because when you drive like that, you run out of juice.
Yeah.
Now, months later, I met up with the first guy. And he says, you know, actually my Tesla, I have to plan where I'm going, you know. I have to think about where I'm going. Because that time the infrastructure wasn't there. Mm. So all this coming now, 2020, they're saying the infrastructure is going to come in, electric cars are going to be adopted. But I still think we are still very far away from being a full, you know, acceptable EV nation.
Yeah.
Because why? Even the third national car is not going to be EV.
Yeah.
If the third national car is not going to be EV, why even bother making a third national car? Because you're just going to compete with everybody else. You're just going to give tax breaks. And this whole philosophy is not going to work. So why isn't Tesla in Malaysia? Because we don't have the infrastructure, like I said before. Why is Tesla not building it? Because they say, it's not our job to build it. You build the infrastructure, I will come and set up shop and sell cars. How long will this carry on for our country? We're not thinking about green environment because petrol is still subsidized. So I think this is all still early talk. So for the last 10 years, we've not seen any change for our country.
This is true, but it's still cool. You got to admit.
Yeah, you got to admit. It's cool, man.
Head snapping.
Yes. Head snapping.
We're going to wrap up and move on. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, of course, we've got stuff from, we're going to call it, as you know it, it's Dieselgate. That's up next. We have to take a short break, of course. You tuned into Cruise Control, the car show here on BFM. I'm Rich Bradbury. I'm in the studio with
Arif Roos
and
Daniel Fernandez.
We'll be right back. BFM 89.9.
Break from monotony. BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, the business station. This is Cruise Control, the car show here on BFM. I'm Rich Bradbury in the studio with
Arif Roos
and
Daniel Fernandez.
It's a bit of a decade in review here. Of course, looking at the auto industry, we've already had a little bit of the rise of crossovers and SUVs. We've talked about the impact of the Tesla Model S. Now, moving swiftly along, Malaysia is no stranger to scandals, shall we say?
Yes.
However, this wasn't born here.
Nope.
This particular scandal, it was born elsewhere.
I'm not even sure this scandal affected us.
I don't.
It didn't, because you know why? They never sold diesels here.
There we go. Yeah, I mean, giving the game away.
They had some grey ones.
What are we talking about, Daniel? What is it?
It's a gate. Yes. And there's a diesel in front of it.
There we go. Dieselgate, of course.
Also known as the biggest automotive industry scandal
in the world
ever.
You did it. A little bit of Clarkson in you. But yeah, so the story goes, in 2014, the California Air Resources Board looked at emissions discrepancies between the European Union cars and US cars by doing tests on the road and not in the lab. So they had a little device that stuck on the cars as they drove along. Mm-hmm. What they found out was that 2/3 of their 15 cars, they only tested 15 cars, emitted hugely excessive emissions, most specifically the nitrogen oxide emissions, which causes acid rain and all that stuff. So most of these cars turned out to be Volkswagen Group cars, and this triggered other regulators to begin investigating Volkswagen for the same causes. As it turned out, VW finally admitted that they used defeat software, so a little program.
Naughty, yeah. Very naughty.
So the thing is, it's all down to the software engineers.
Right? Yeah, right. Yeah. Where are they from?
I didn't want to say anything.
So these, you know, defeat software, these programs were used to manipulate the car's emissions, obviously, but the thing about it was that it could detect when the car was doing an emissions cycle test. So I guess in a lab, you got to plug in the car into a wall or something like that, right?
Have you seen some of the videos for this? I've seen. Okay, so one of the ways in which they tricked the software is that they knew that when this car was in a lab and it was on a treadmill, when it's on a treadmill, it goes in a straight line.
Yeah.
So whilst it was going in a straight line, there were no emissions, right? And so when they took it out on the roads, of course, which have curves and bends, and it was when it was tilted and going around a corner, that's when the emission would come out. So it would poop as it's going, if you like, while it's going around a corner, and when it's straightened up, no poop. In a lab, everything is straight, no poop.
That's true. And no matter how much you strain the engine, it's still about the same, right? So in the real world, these Volkswagen Group cars actually emitted up to 40 times their claimed NOx emissions. And during this time also, when Volkswagen was doing it, 2008, 2009, 10, 11, 12, they were receiving like awards for everything diesel related.
Yes.
And they apparently did this because they wanted to obtain green car subsidies and tax exemptions in the US and Germany and a few different countries.
Because US has never been a diesel market.
Mm. No. And as we know, California's...
That planet on the west coast of America.
They are very, very, very strict on emissions regulations, and especially even sound or any sort of pollution release. So they were trying to capture that market, to say. So they did it somewhat successfully. Like I said, you know, they gained a lot of clean diesel awards and all that stuff, which were supposedly cleaner, and their engines were more efficient and more powerful. But the big picture of Dieselgate is that it wasn't just Volkswagen was the only car company to do it. Other makes like Volvo, Renault, Nissan, GM, Hyundai and Fiat had all done the same. The only reason why Volkswagen was the focus of this scandal was because their discrepancies was huge.
And here's what raised the question for me at the time. Was like, you hear about all these other companies doing it, right? And did they just get in a room together one day and have this discussion about how can we get away with this?
I tell you what happened.
Because
the moment one gets away with it, that engineer...
That's what I'm thinking.
We'll go to the competitor and say, listen, do you want to hire me?
Right.
I got a way for you to do this.
Right.
And then another engineer from that company leaves and then goes to the next company.
Right. All these engineers all went to the same university. Exactly. They're all friends of friends and they're calling each other
up.
WhatsApping one another.
Most popular
Exactly. They're sending each other a good morning message. Yeah. Hey, good morning.
Do you want to fake a diesel emission test?
The other thing, seriously, and I don't know how to say this without using this word, but the balls of these companies to think that they could get away with this and there not be repercussions is just staggering.
Yep. But you see, even after the fines, tell us how much fines.
Total fines from when the investigation started in 2015 until now, $35 billion US dollars.
Okay, I'm glad you said that. Where's that money?
Yeah. Yeah, where's it gone?
Various governments and federal agencies, I assume.
Settlements.
Okay. And
so,
settlements.
So now, where did they get $35 billion from? For a company that's not very successful.
Volkswagen not being successful? Yeah. They've been successful up until Dieselgate.
Really?
Yeah.
And they're still successful?
Of course they are. Because we've got short-term memories. And we've just gone, don't worry about that. They're not going to do it again, are they? They've had a slap on the wrist.
Exactly.
Yeah. Sorry, Volkswagen, but you've got to be called out on this. Come on.
Yeah, you do. I mean, as a result of all of these things, when it was revealed, Volkswagen Auto Group's CEO, Martin Winterkorn, resigned. It was followed by the resignation of Audi and Porsche's research and development heads, as well as Volkswagen Group's brand development head. And then it was followed by many, many different charges of defrauding investors.
Like dominoes.
Stock market manipulation, conspiracy. Then there were accusations of defrauding the European Investment Bank of something like $40 billion US dollars or something like that. And then eventually all of these people that was involved in this scandal, most notably the Volkswagen Group's top management, they all got prison sentences, which, considering the amount of money and the amount of things that they had, some of them got 10 to 15 years, I would say, only.
I mean, stock market prices plummeting, 39%. Worldwide investigations on other manufacturers, a decreased confidence in diesel, of course.
Yep.
That was a Here's the thing. Over in the UK, diesel cars for the longest time were doing very
Number
well.
Number one.
Yeah.
They
Number
were
one.
Doing very well. You know, and
in Europe
this,
at one time, 70% of cars were diesel.
Yeah.
Now it's...
It's practically zero.
Exactly. Nobody wants to buy a diesel car anymore. Right. But the thing is, you walk around, you come here in Malaysia, you walk around, there's no Malaysian gate.
Right.
Look at all the smoky vehicles.
I mean, there is. It's just not in the automotive industry. Yeah.
There's no Malaysian gate here after all the smoky vehicles.
We need one.
Yep. Right, should we move on?
Next.
Yep. So next one is a short review, I guess, decade review of the automotive technology. So everything from engines to computers and engines more specifically, I think that's gotten the biggest jump without talking about electric powertrains and all that stuff. Nowadays, you have a small efficient engine, 1.8 liter.
Smaller displacement,
big turbocharger or small and a big turbocharger.
Right. Higher output.
Higher output, yeah. So one comparison I drew was of my car. Okay. 9 years ago, a 3 Series...
Sorry, you mean BMW?
Yes.
Just say it. Yes.
9 years ago, a BMW 3 Series would have produced 3 Series would have produced about 215 horsepower and 250 newton meters of torque. Today's 3 Series produces 400 newton meters of torque and 255 horsepower and consumes more than 4 liters less per 100 kilometers. So that is...
Win-win.
Win-win.
Very good.
There's also a bunch of different new technologies these days. Have you heard of beltless engines?
Yes.
Just the new Mercedes mild hybrid system. Basically, right. They don't have any belts or tensioners that you have to replace. Everything's
is that why
just...
they're called beltless? Because they have no belts?
Mm.
Yes.
It's just like you. You're beltless.
I'm beltless. That's because I've got a belly, though.
Exactly.
There's also cylinder deactivation. It's not a new thing, but
that's been around for quite some time.
Yep. Yes. It's popular right now. So yes. I think Ford was the one that really made it a big thing when they launched their V8. And they said the engine could just run on 2 cylinders just like that at a stoplight.
But the person that made it popular is Audi.
Huh.
The ones that made it globally popular is Audi. They advertised it very, very, very much because they thought this is the best way to say that. You know, a big car, you can still run on 2 cylinders when you're cruising along
the
highway.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, yeah. Yes. The V8s that turn into V4s.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And then, you know, recently we've heard of the Skyactiv X engine.
Reinventing the petrol engine.
Yep. Basically, you get diesel efficiency with petrol power and cleanliness. Mm. And what it does is change the compression ratio of the engine on the fly.
Just like an advertisement, then.
I'm sorry.
Efficiency with petrol power.
It's just so interesting to me. I just love it. The other big, huge thing that affected the automotive industry as a whole is all the computers, the sensors, the cameras, and connectivity, which basically led to increased levels of driver aids, safety features, self-driving technology, and engine management systems, which enabled all of these things to happen. And then you have features like side collision warning. I think 2010, we wouldn't have expected to have these sort of things. You have lane keep assist, 360-degree cameras, driver alert systems, which means that the car can technically drive itself as long as it's by itself with little white lines in between.
And here's the rub, right? The kind of double-edged sword of all these wonderful pieces of technology that we're getting. You're getting away from why most people picked up a car in the first place.
To drive it.
To drive it. Oh, I love all of these gadgets, but in 5 years' time, you're like, what do I do apart from get in and sit down?
Yeah. You might as well just get ride-hailing.
Right, that's it.
Which leads us to the next and final segment of this decade in review, which is new mobility and vehicle ownership.
Right.
A lot of car companies are starting to think of themselves as, you know, tech companies rather than car builders or car manufacturers. They provide services, mobility as a service.
True.
So there are, since 2010, a lot of new apps and technologies that provide consumers with mobility options, i.e. Uber.
You know what? Life here in Malaysia before Grab, Uber, and so on and so forth was a very different place.
I think so too.
And, you know, as much as we complain about certain ride-hailing services, I have to take my hat off to them and say, you know, they have changed the way in which many Malaysians and expats, Daniel, get around the Klang Valley and elsewhere. And if it wasn't for them, I'll give you an example. We were up in Langkawi just a couple of weeks ago, and the prices of taxis up in Langkawi is supremely cheap if you use a ride-hailing service.
Correct.
Before that, it was...
ridiculously expensive.
You always had to negotiate with the driver.
Yes. And the other day, there was a foreign couple who wanted to get from Chenang Beach, and they were going back to their cruise ship because they can afford that. And this taxi driver wanted to charge them an awful lot of money. It was like 80 or 90, even 100 ringgit, I think, something along those lines. Some friendly local came past and said, you should use the Grab app, showed them how to download it, 16 ringgit. Mm. You know?
Whoa, my God.
Boom. Just the amount of saving... Right.
It's
crazy.
And it's basically changed the way people see taxis, I think.
For sure.
Yeah,
but you see, your example of that taxi driver wanting to charge 100
ringgit. It's an extreme example.
Yes, and the ride-hailing guy who charged 16 ringgit.
Yeah.
Now that taxi driver can't feed his family.
Oh, please. Oh, please.
Because he lost out on 86 ringgit.
Honesty is the best policy. Yeah. If you're charging people 16 ringgit, they're going to come back to you over and over again.
But
if he charges them 80 ringgit, they're going to be talking about you on radio the week afterwards.
Yeah, but they're foreign tourists. They just come once and they leave. They came on a cruise ship, like you said. They can afford to pay 100 ringgit.
I mean, apart from all the benefits that it's given us, the super convenience and accountability and all that stuff, there have been a lot of problems over the years.
Of course.
One of which, you know, is the classification issues. Yeah. Are these drivers employees? Are they part-time contract workers? Yeah. Nobody knows. And until some Uber drivers in California and in New York actually brought them up, they were talking about things like, you know, we don't receive overtime, we don't receive any employee benefits, and we earn a small share of what the entire fare is throughout the day. So if you earn $100, maybe you will get something like $40 and the $60 goes to Uber. And they were all arguing a lot about that.
That just sounds like the airport taxi in KLIA.
It's exactly the same. It's exactly the same.
The license holder earns 60 ringgit. Yeah. The driver earns 40 ringgit. So what is it so different?
Allegedly.
Yes.
Glad you mentioned the airport taxis thing. And you know how there were these big protests from Big Blue Taxi Corporation, right? And they were like, oh, these ride-hailing companies actually don't comply to a lot of the taxi regulations, correct, even though they're technically a taxi, they're just not classified as one.
Stuff like safety, of course. You know, safety of passengers was something that was a big thing.
Yeah.
You know, but again, that comes back down to the accountability. You can see the guy who's taking you, and you can see their name, where they've registered. There's a photograph of them. A lot of the times you just get in some random cab with somebody you've never seen before or again.
And a very old taxi.
Yeah.
That too.
It's not properly maintained.
I think back then, I would have... Back then, if I had to get somewhere, maybe a short distance, I would have just walked the 45 minutes to get somewhere.
I refuse.
But now I have a Grab app. I'll just, you know, screw it. Yeah. 5 ringgit, I'll just take
the cab. So I'm going to ask you a question now. I'm going to ask both of you a question. You've been here a few years, right?
11 years.
Oh, my God.
I know.
The amount of money that Malaysians have lost in salary. Okay, I just want to know something. Because I did this with a friend of mine.
I said,
how much do you use in terms of ride hailing in a month?
How much do I use? I come to work every day using it. Okay. And I go back home every day using it.
In between and everything
else. In between, I'm using
it. So what's the total amount?
Less than I would pay if I was to purchase a car still.
Okay, so you're saying maybe less than 1,000 ringgit?
Less than 1,000 ringgit,
So you've benefited?
I've benefited,
from the ride-hailing industry?
I've sat and done the maths,
okay,
and it works out better for me to use ride-hailing.
Because you don't have to pay for parking.
Correct.
Maintenance, petrol,
insurance,
road tax.
The whole thing.
You don't have to worry if you have a small accident.
That's right.
And you're not someone who's proud to say, oh, I own a car.
Correct.
Or you're not someone who's even interested to have a car parked in your garage. Because
I mean, I'd like that, but you know.
Yeah, but you know, you want to wake up in the morning and sip your coffee and look at your car.
No, I don't feel the need to do that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of people who are moving in that direction, including the younger generation.
Yeah.
And I think that puts me out of a job.
Well, you know, you could be reviewing taxi rides.
Exactly. Because pretty soon... there'd be no cruise control for me.
I mean, wait, but like I said, you know, all of these car companies are providing mobility services.
Yes.
So you can review the car that they give to people for a day.
But you see, people will still take those cars not based on a review because it's a mobility service.
So I think we are running out of a bit
of
time.
True. Depressing.
Just to run out these last few points, which is subscription models, point-to-point rentals, and self-driving taxis, which is basically go-car, so-car, share-to-go. So car companies are basically reflecting on slowing sales, slowing global sales, higher costs in production, complexities in production as well, and consumer ownership. People just don't want to spend so much money on cars.
Especially here.
And the global focus on car-free cities and public transport, which is a very, very good thing. So car companies look at themselves like, we can't really get people to own our cars anymore. So what are we going to do? We're just going to make them use our cars to get somewhere. To share it, And the advent of self-driving cars kind of adds another aspect to this, to the future of mobility, you know, trying to sell the idea of, like I said, manufacturer services, mobility as a service. So one question I have for you guys is, do you think we will be doing the sort of thing? Do we think, like, we won't own a car, but to get to work, I will just use my app just to, like, you know, beep, boop, 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 and the car will come by.
Which is what Richard is doing right now.
Yeah.
But I think for you, it'll take another 10 years. For me, I'll be dead and gone. For this to totally change, it'll take another 10 to 15 years, which will be just in time for me to retire.
I suppose, final question before we leave. what will cars be like for the masses and what will it be like for car enthusiasts?
For the next 10 years?
Mm. Yeah.
In the next 10 years?
Full of motion, zero emotion.
Oh, I like that.
Oh.
Write that down.
It's already patented. Oh, yeah. Like how you patented something last night.
I think he's fairly right. I mean, it's not going to be too different to what I'm doing now. I get into a vehicle with something that's emotionless.
Yes.
I take that back. You know, you're going to get into a vehicle that is essentially going to be driving itself to the destination that you need to go to. It's going to be fairly cheap because they're going to be ubiquitous. They're going to be cheap to produce. They're going to be safe because they're going to be talking to one another along that road, should those roads be designed correctly. And I think the one problem that we are going to have to solve looking forward will be the last mile thing, you know, in terms of automation. That's what I think is the next step, but I think it's basically going to be automated vehicles in the next 10, 15 years. Yeah, for sure.
I totally agree with that. But I think there is still space for petrol-driven engines.
No doubt.
Car enthusiasts, I think we are
still
be okay.
There will still be, but it'll just be shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, like soon, my hairline.
Soon we'll have to collect enough money to buy an Aston Martin DBX.
True.
And you'll only be able to look at it in your garage. It'll be like some kind of museum piece, won't it?
Yep.
Totally. Starting it up once a month, switching it on, revving that engine, backing it out.
Getting the neighbours to complain.
And then backing it back in again. Yeah. Done.
So I want to know what you guys think, the listeners, about this list in general and your predictions for the next decade. And how has it changed your opinion on cars and the car industry? And what are you looking forward to in the future? Let us know on Twitter at BFM Radio.
Or you can get us via WhatsApp 018-789-8899. And of course, we are on Instagram
at BFM Cruise Control.
This has been Cruise Control, a look back at the decade in review for the auto industry. I'm Rich Bradbury. I've been in the studio with
Arif Roos,
Daniel Fernandez
from
DSF.my.
We will be back in the new year.
Yes.
Have yourselves a wonderful day. See you soon, folks.
BFM 89.9.
Is this the last show for the year?
Is it?
Yeah, it's the last show of the year.
Okay. Are you sure?
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.